I told him that I had nothing to do with Onitsuka's announcement. I assured him that Onitsuka was trying to bully us into selling, but they were our past, and Nisho, like Nike, was our future. In closing, I confessed to Sumeragi that I hadn't yet mentioned any of this to Onitsuka, so mum's the word. I ask that you keep the above information in strict confidence for obvious reasons. In order to maintain our present distribution system for future Nike sales, it's important that we have about 1 or 2 more months of shipments from Onitsuka, and if these shipments were cut off, it would be very harmful. I felt like a married man caught in a tawdry love triangle. I was assuring my lover, Nisho, that it was only a matter of time before I divorced my spouse, Onitsuka. Meanwhile, I was encouraging Onitsuka to think of me as a loving and devoted husband. "I do not like this way of doing business," I wrote Sumeragi, "but I feel it was thrust upon us by a company with the worst possible intentions. We'll be together soon, darling. Just have patience." Right before we all left for Chicago, a wire came from Kitami. He'd thought up a name for our new company. The Tiger Shoe Company. He wanted me to unveil it in Chicago. I wired back that the name was beautiful, lyrical, pure poetry. But alas, it was too late to unveil anything at the show. All the signs and promotional literature had been printed already. On day one of the show, I walked into the convention center and found Johnson and Woodell already busy arranging our booth. They'd stacked the new Tigers in neat rows, and now they were stacking the new Nikes in pyramids of orange shoeboxes. In those days, shoeboxes were either white or blue, period. But I'd wanted something that would stand out, that would pop on the shelves of sporting goods stores. So I'd asked Nippon Rubber for boxes of bright neon orange, figuring it was the boldest color in the rainbow. Johnson and Woodell loved the orange and loved the lowercase Nike lettered in white on the side of the box. But as they opened the boxes and examined the shoes themselves, both men were shaken up. These shoes, the first wave produced by Nippon Rubber, didn't have the quality of Tigers, nor of the samples we'd seen earlier. The leather was shiny, and not in a good way. The wet flight looked literally wet, as if covered with cheap paint or lacquer that hadn't dried. The upper was coated with polyurethane, but apparently Nippon was no more proficient than Bowerman at working with that tricky mercurial substance. The logo on the side, Carolyn's wing whoosh thingamajig, which we'd taken to calling a swoosh, was crooked. I sat down and put my head in my hands. I looked at our orange pyramids. My mind went to the pyramids in Giza. Only 10 years before I'd been there, riding a camel like Lawrence of Arabia across the sands, free as a man could be. Now I was in Chicago, saddled with debt, head of a teetering shoe company, rolling out a new brand with shoddy workmanship and crooked swooshes. All is vanity. I gazed around the convention center at the thousands of sales reps swarming the booths, the other booths. I heard them oohing and aahing at all the other shoes being introduced for the first time. I was that boy at the science fair who didn't work hard enough on his project, who didn't start until the night before. The other kids had built erupting volcanoes and lightning machines, and all I had was a solar system made with apples and mothballs stuck to my mother's coat hangers. Damn it, this was no time to be introducing flawed shoes. Worse, we had to push these flawed shoes on people who weren't our kind of people. They were salesmen. They talked like salesmen, walked like salesmen, and they dressed like salesmen. Tight polyester shirts, sansevieria slacks. They were extroverts, we were introverts. They didn't get us, we didn't get them, and yet our future depended on them. And now we'd have to persuade them somehow that this Nike thing was worth their time and trust and money. I was on the verge of losing it, right on the verge. Then I saw that Johnson and Woodell were already losing it, and I realized that I couldn't afford to. Like Penny, they beat me to the panic attack punch. "Look," I said, "fellas, this is the worst the shoes will ever be. They'll get better. So if we can just sell these, we'll be on our way." Each gave a resigned shake of the head. What choice do we have? We looked out, and here they came, a mob of salesmen, walking like zombies toward our booth. They picked up the Nikes, held them to the light. They touched the swoosh. One said to another, "The hell is this?"
"Hell if I know," said the other.
They started to barrage us with questions. "Hey, what is this?" "That's a Nike." "The hell's a Nike?" "It's the Greek goddess of victory."
"Greek what now?"
"Goddess of victory. And what's this?"
"That's a swoosh."
"The hell's a swoosh?" The answer flew out of me. "It's the sound of someone going past you."
They liked that. Oh, they liked it a whole lot.
They gave us business. They actually placed orders with us. By the end of the day, we'd exceeded our grandest expectations. We were one of the smash hits of the show. At least, that's how I saw it. Johnson, as usual, wasn't happy. Ever the perfectionist. "The irregularities of this whole situation," he said, left him dumbfounded. That was his phrase. "The irregularities of this whole situation." I begged him to take his dumbfoundedness and irregularity elsewhere, leave well enough alone. But he just couldn't. He walked over and buttonholed one of his biggest accounts and demanded to know what was going on.
"What do you mean?" the man said.
"I mean," Johnson said, "we show up with this new Nike, and it's totally untested, and frankly, it's not even all that good, and you guys are buying it? What gives?"
The man laughed.
"We've been doing business with you Blue Ribbon guys for years," he said. "We know that you guys tell the truth. Everyone else bullshits. You guys always shoot straight. So if you say this new shoe, this Nike, is worth a shot, we believe."
Johnson came back to the booth, scratching his head. "Telling the truth," he said. "Who knew?"
Johnson laughed. Waddell laughed. I laughed and tried not to think about my many half-truths and untruths with Onitsuka. Good news travels fast. Bad news travels faster than Grella and Prefontaine on a rocket. 2 weeks after Chicago, Kitami walked into my office. No advance notice, no heads up. And he cut right to the car chase. "What is this thing?" he demanded. "This Nike." I made my face blank.
"Nike? Oh, it's nothing. It's a sideline we've developed to hedge our bets in case Onitsuka does as threatened and yanks the rug out from under us."
The answer disarmed him, as it should have. I'd rehearsed it for weeks. It was so reasonable and logical that Kitami didn't know how to respond. He'd come spoiling for a fight, and I'd countered his bull rush with a rope-a-dope. He demanded to know who made the new shoes. I told him they were made by different factories in Japan. He demanded to know how many Nikes we'd ordered.
"A few thousand," I said.
He gave an O. I wasn't sure what that meant. I didn't mention that two members of my scrappy hometown Portland Trailblazers had just worn Nikes during a rout of the New York Knicks, 133-86. The Oregonian had recently run a photo of Jeff Petrie driving past a Nick, Phil Jackson by name, and visible on Petrie's shoes was a swoosh. We'd just made a deal with a couple of other Blazers to supply them with shoes, too. Good thing the Oregonian didn't have a wide circulation in Kobe. Kitami asked if the new Nike was in stores. "Of course not," I lied. Or fibbed. He asked when I was going to sign his papers and sell him my company. I told him my partner still hadn't decided. End of meeting. He buttoned and unbuttoned the coat of his suit and said he had other business in California. But he'd be back. He marched out of my office, and for the first time in half an hour, I unclenched. I immediately reached for the phone and dialed our retail store in Los Angeles. Bork answered. "John, our old friend Kitami is coming to town. I'm sure he'll come by your store. Don't let him in the stockroom."
"Huh?"
"He knows about Nikes, but I told him it isn't in stores."
"What you're asking of me?" Bork said.
"I don't know." He sounded frightened and irritated.
He didn't want to do anything dishonest, he said. I'm asking you to stash a few pairs of shoes, I cried, then slammed down the phone. Sure enough, Kitami showed up that afternoon. He confronted Bork, badgered him with questions, shook him down like a cop with a shaky witness. Bork played dumb, or so he told me later. Kitami asked to use the bathroom. A ploy, of course. He knew the bathroom was somewhere in the back, and he needed an excuse to snoop back there. Bork didn't see the ploy, or didn't care to. Moments later, Kitami was standing in the stockroom under a bare light bulb, glowering at hundreds of orange shoeboxes. Nike, Nike everywhere, and not a drop to drink. Bork phoned me after Kitami left. Jigs up, he said. What happened, I asked. Kitami forced his way into the stockroom. It's over, Phil. I hung up, slumped in my chair. Well, I said, out loud to no one, I guess we're going to find out if we can exist without Tiger. We found out something else, too. Soon after that day, Bork quit. Actually, I don't remember if he quit or Woodell fired him. Either way, not long after that, we heard that Bork had a new job. Working for Kitami. I spent days and days staring into space, gazing out windows, waiting for Kitami to play his next card. I also watched a lot of TV. The nation, the world, was agog at the sudden opening of relations between the United States and China. President Nixon was in Beijing, shaking hands with Mao Zedong, an event nearly on a par with the moon landing. I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime, a U.S. president in the Forbidden City, touching the Great Wall. I thought of my time in Hong Kong. I'd been so close to China, and yet so far. I thought I'd never have another chance. But now I thought, one day? Maybe? Maybe. At last, Kitami made his move. He returned to Oregon and asked for a meeting, at which he requested that Bowerman be present. To make that easier for Bowerman, I suggested Jaqua's office down in Eugene as the site. When the day came, as we were all filing into the conference room, Jaqua grabbed my arm and whispered, "Whatever he says, you say nothing." I nodded. On one side of the conference table were Jaqua, Bowerman, and me. On the other side were Kitami and his lawyer, a local guy, who didn't look like he wanted to be there. Plus, Iwano was back. I thought he might have half-smiled at me before remembering that this wasn't a social call. Jake's conference room was bigger than ours in Tigard, but that day it felt like a dollhouse. Kitami had asked for the meeting, so he kicked it off, and he didn't beat around the bonsai tree. He handed Jaqua a letter. Effective immediately, our contract with Onitsuka was null and void. He looked at me, then back to Jaqua. "Very, very regret," he said. Furthermore, insult to injury, he was billing us $17,000, which he claimed we owed for shoes delivered. To be exact, he demanded $16,637.13. Jaqua pushed the letter aside and said that if Kitami dared to pursue this reckless course, if he insisted on cutting us off, we'd sue. "You caused this," Kitami said. "Blue Ribbon had breached its contract with Onitsuka by making Nike shoes," he said, and he was at a loss to understand why we'd ruined such a profitable relationship. Why we'd launched this Nike. That was more than I could bear. "I'll tell you why," I blurted. Jaqua turned on me and shouted, "Shut up, Buck." Jaqua then told Kitami that he hoped something could still be worked out. A lawsuit would be highly damaging to both companies. Peace would mean prosperity. But Kitami was in no mood for peace. He stood, motioned to his lawyer and Iwano to follow. When he got to the door, he stopped. His face changed. He was about to say something conciliatory. He was preparing to offer an olive branch. I felt myself softening toward him. "Onitsuka," he said,
like to continue use Mr. Bowerman as consultant. I pulled on my ear. Surely I hadn't heard him correctly. Bowerman shook his head and turned to Jaqua, who said that Bowerman would henceforth consider Katami a competitor, a.k.a. a sworn enemy, and would help him in no way whatsoever. Kitami nodded. He asked if someone could please drive him and Iwano to the airport. I told Johnson to get on a plane. What plane, he said. The next plane, I said. He arrived the following morning. We went for a run, during which neither of us said anything. Then we drove to the office and gathered everyone into the conference room. There were about 30 people there. I expected to be nervous. They expected me to be nervous. On any different day, under any other circumstances, I would have been. For some reason, however, I felt weirdly at peace. I laid out the situation we faced. We've come, folks, to a crossroads. Yesterday, our main supplier, Onitsuka, cut us off. I let that sink in. I watched everyone's jaw drop. We've threatened to sue them for damages, I said. And, of course, they've threatened to file a lawsuit of their own. Breach of contract. If they sue us first in Japan, we'll have no choice but to sue them here in America, and sue fast. We're not going to win a lawsuit in Japan, so we'll have to beat them to the courthouse, get a quick verdict here to pressure them into withdrawing. Meanwhile, until it all sorts out, we're completely on our own. We're set adrift. We have this new line, Nike, which the reps in Chicago seem to like. But, well, frankly, that's all we've got. And, as we know, there are big problems with the quality. It's not what we hoped. Communications with Nippon Rubber are good, and Nisho is there at the factory at least once a week, trying to get it all fixed, but we don't know how soon they can do it. It better be soon, though, because we have no time and suddenly no margin for error. I looked down the table. Everyone was sinking, slumping forward. I looked at Johnson. He was staring at the papers before him, and there was something in his handsome face, some quality I'd never seen there before. Surrender. Like everyone else in the room, he was giving up. The nation's economy was in the tank, a recession was underway. Gas lines, political gridlock, rising unemployment, Nixon being Nixon, Vietnam. It seemed like the end times. Everyone in the room had already been worrying about how they were going to make the rent, pay the light bill. Now this. I cleared my throat. So, in other words, I said. I cleared my throat again, pushed aside my yellow legal pad. What I'm trying to say is we've got them right where we want them. Johnson lifted his eyes. Everyone around the table lifted their eyes. They sat up straighter. This is the moment, I said. This is the moment we've been waiting for. Our moment. No more selling someone else's brand. No more working for someone else. Onitsuka has been holding us back for years. Their late deliveries, their mixed-up orders, their refusal to hear and implement our design ideas. Who among us isn't sick of dealing with all that? It's time we faced facts. If we're going to succeed or fail, we should do so on our own terms, with our own ideas, our own brand. We posted $2 million in sales last year, none of which had anything to do with Onitsuka. That number was a testament to our ingenuity and hard work. Let's not look at this as a crisis. Let's look at this as our liberation, our Independence Day. Yes, it's going to be rough. I won't lie to you. We're definitely going to war, people, but we know the terrain. We know our way around Japan now. And that's one reason I feel in my heart this is a war we can win. And if we win it, when we win it, I see great things for us on the other side of victory. We are still alive, people. We are still alive. As I stopped speaking, I could see a wave of relief swirl around the table like a cool breeze. Everyone felt it. It was as real as the wind that used to swirl around the office next to the pink bucket. There were nods, murmurs, nervous chuckles. We spent the next hour brainstorming about how to proceed, how to hire contract factories, how to play them against one another for the best quality and price, and how we were going to fix these new Nikes. Anyone? We adjourned with a jovial, jittery, elated feeling. Johnson said he wanted to buy me a cup of coffee. "Your finest hour," he said. "Ah," I said, "thanks." But I reminded him. I just told the truth, as he had in Chicago. "Telling the truth," I said. "Who knew?" Johnson went back to Wellesley for the time being, and we turned our attention to the Olympic track and field trials, which in 1972 were being held for the first time ever in our backyard, Eugene. We needed to own those trials, so we sent an advance team down to give shoes to any competitor willing to take them. And we set up a staging area in our store, which was now being ably run by Hollister. As the trials opened, we set up a silkscreen machine in the back of the store and cranked out scores of Nike t-shirts, which Penny handed out like Halloween candy. With all that work, how could we not break through? And indeed, Dave Davis, a shot putter from USC, dropped by the store the first day to complain that he wasn't getting free stuff from either Adidas or Puma, so he'd gladly take our shoes and wear them. And then he finished fourth. Hooray! Better yet, he didn't just wear our shoes, he waltzed around in one of Penny's t-shirts, his name stenciled on the back. The trouble was, Dave wasn't the ideal model. He had a bit of a gut. And our t-shirts weren't big enough, which accentuated his gut. We made a note. Buy smaller athletes or make bigger shirts. We also had a couple of semi-finalists wear our spikes, including an employee, Jim Gorman, who competed in the 1500. I told Gorman he was taking corporate loyalty too far. Our spikes weren't that great. But he insisted that he was in all the way. And then in the marathon, we had Nike shod runners finish 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th. None made the team, but still, not too shabby. The main event of the trials, of course, would come on the final day. A duel between Prefontaine and the great Olympian George Young. By then, Prefontaine was universally known as Pre, and he was far more than a phenom. He was an outright superstar. He was the biggest thing to hit the world of American track and field since Jesse Owens. Sports writers frequently compared him to James Dean and Mick Jagger, and Runner's World said the most apt comparison might be Muhammad Ali. He was that kind of swaggery, transformative figure. To my thinking, however, these and all other comparisons fell short. Pre was unlike any athlete this country had ever seen, though it was hard to say exactly why. I'd spent a lot of time studying him, admiring him, puzzling about his appeal. I'd asked myself, time and again, what it was about Pre that triggered such visceral responses from so many people, including myself. I never did come up with a totally satisfactory answer. It was more than his talent. There were other talented runners. And it was more than his swagger. There were plenty of swaggering runners. Some said it was his look. Pre was so fluid, so poetic, with that flowing mop of hair. And he had the broadest, deepest chest imaginable, set on slender legs that were all muscle and never stopped churning. Also, most runners are introverts, but Pre was an obvious, joyous extrovert. It was never simply running for him. He was always putting on a show, always conscious of the spotlight. Sometimes I thought the secret to Pre's appeal was his passion, his fire. He didn't care if he died crossing the finish line, so long as he crossed first. No matter what Bowerman told him, no matter what his body told him, Pre refused to slow down, ease off. He pushed himself to the brink and beyond. This was often a counterproductive strategy, and sometimes it was plainly stupid, and occasionally it was suicidal. But it was always uplifting for the crowd.
No matter the sport, no matter the human endeavor, really, total effort will win people's hearts. Of course, all Oregonians loved Pri because he was ours. He was born in our midst, raised in our rainy forests, and we'd cheered him since he was a pup. We'd watched him break the national 2-mile record as an 18-year-old, and we were with him step by step through each glorious NCAA championship. Every Oregonian felt emotionally invested in his career. And at Blue Ribbon, of course, we were preparing to invest our cash, to put our money where our emotions were. We understood that Pri couldn't switch shoes right before the trials. He was used to his Adidas. But in time, we were certain he'd be a Nike athlete, and perhaps the paradigmatic Nike athlete. With these thoughts in mind, walking down Agate Street toward Hayward Field, I wasn't surprised to find the place shaking, rocking, trembling with cheers. The Colosseum in Rome could not have been louder when the gladiators and lions were turned loose. We found our seats just in time to see Pri doing his warm-ups. Every move he made caused a new ripple of excitement. Every time he jogged down one side of the oval or up the other, the fans along his route stood and went wild. Half of them were wearing T-shirts that read, "Legend." All of a sudden, we heard a chorus of deep, guttural boos. Gary Lindgren, arguably the world's best distance runner at the time, appeared on the track, wearing a T-shirt that read, "Stop Pri." It made our hearts pound. Lindgren had beaten Pri when he was a senior and Pri a freshman, and he wanted everyone, especially Pri, to remember. But when Pri saw Lindgren and saw the shirt, he just shook his head and smiled. No pressure, only a bit more incentive. The runners took their marks. An unearthly silence fell. Then, bang! The starting gun sounded like a Napoleon cannon. Pri took the lead right away. Young tucked in right behind him. In no time, they pulled well ahead of the field, and it became a 2-man affair. Lindgren was far behind, a non-factor. Each man's strategy was clear. Young meant to stay with Pri until the final lap, then use his superior sprint to go by and win. Pri, meanwhile, intended to set such a fast pace at the outset that by the time they got to that final lap, Young's legs would be gone. For 11 laps, they ran a half stride apart. With the crowd now roaring, frothing, shrieking, the two men entered the final lap. It felt like a boxing match. It felt like a joust. It felt like a bullfight, and we were down to that moment of truth, death hanging in the air. Pri reached down, found another level. We saw him do it. He opened up a yard lead, then two, then five. We saw Young grimacing, and we knew that he could not, would not catch Pri. I told myself, don't forget this. Do not forget. I told myself there was much to be learned from such a display of passion, whether you were running a mile or a company. As they crossed the tape, we all looked up at the clock and saw that both men had broken the American record. Pri had broken it by a shade more, but he wasn't done. He spotted someone waving a Stop Pri T-shirt. He went over and snatched it and whipped it in circles above his head like a scalp. What followed was one of the greatest ovations I've ever heard, and I've spent my life in stadiums. I'd never witnessed anything quite like that race. And yet I didn't just witness it, I took part in it. Days later, I felt sore in my hams and quads. This, I decided, this is what sports are, what they can do. Like books, sports give people a sense of having lived other lives, of taking part in other people's victories and defeats. When sports are at their best, the spirit of the fan merges with the spirit of the athlete. And in that convergence, in that transference, is the oneness that the mystics talk about. Walking back down Agate Street, I knew that race was part of me, would forever be part of me.
and I vowed it would also be part of Blue Ribbon. In our coming battles with Onitsuka, with whomever, we'd be like Pri. We'd compete as if our lives depended on it. Because they did. Next, with saucer eyes, we looked to the Olympics. Not only was our man Bowerman going to be the head coach of the track team, but our homeboy Pri was going to be the star. After his performance at the trials, who could doubt it? Certainly not Pri. Sure, there will be a lot of pressure, he told Sports Illustrated. And a lot of us will be facing more experienced competitors, and maybe we don't have any right to win. But all I know is if I go out and bust my gut until I black out and somebody still beats me, if I have made that guy reach down and use everything he has and then more, why then it just proves that on that day he's a better man than I. Right before Pri and Bowerman left for Germany, I filed for a patent on Bowerman's waffle shoe. Application number 284,736 described the improved sole having integral polygon-shaped studs of square, rectangular, or triangle cross-section, and a plurality of flat sides which provide gripping edges that give greatly improved traction. A proud moment for both of us. A golden moment of my life. Sales of Nike were steady. My son was healthy and thriving. I was able to pay my mortgage on time. All things considered, I was in a damn fine mood that August. And then it began. In the second week of the Olympic Games, a squad of 8 masked gunmen scaled a back wall of the Olympic Village and kidnapped 11 Israeli athletes. In our tigered office, we set up a TV and no one did a lick of work. We watched and watched day after day, saying little, often holding our hands over our mouths. When the terrible denouement came, when the news broke that all the athletes were dead, their bodies strewn on a blood-spattered tarmac at the airport, it recalled the deaths of both Kennedys and of Dr. King and of the students at Kent State University and of all the tens of thousands of boys in Vietnam. Ours was a difficult, death-drenched age, and at least once every day you were forced to ask yourself, what's the point? When Bowerman returned, I drove straight down to Eugene to see how he was faring. He looked as though he hadn't slept in a decade. He told me that he and Pri had been within a hair of the attack. In the first minutes, as the terrorists took control of the building, many Israeli athletes were able to flee, slipping out side doors, jumping out windows. One made his way to the next building over, where Bowerman and Pri were staying. Bowerman heard a knock, opened the door of his room, and found this man, a race walker, shivering with fear, babbling about masked gunmen. Bowerman pulled the man inside and phoned the U.S. consul. "Send the Marines," he shouted into the phone. They did. Marines quickly secured the building where Bowerman and the U.S. team were staying. For this overreaction, Bowerman was severely reprimanded by Olympic officials. He'd exceeded his authority, they said. In the heat of the crisis, they made time to summon Bowerman to their headquarters. Thank goodness Jesse Owens, the hero of the last German Olympics, the man who beat Hitler, went with Bowerman and voiced his support for Bowerman's actions. That forced the bureaucrats to back off. Bowerman and I sat and stared at the river for a long while, saying little. Then, his voice scratchy, Bowerman told me that those 1972 Olympics marked the low point of his life. I'd never heard him say a thing like that, and I'd never seen him look like that. Defeated. I couldn't believe it. The cowards never started, and the weak died along the way. That leaves us. Soon after that day, Bowerman announced that he was retiring from coaching. A grim time. Skies were grayer than usual and low. There was no fall. We just woke up and winter was upon us. The trees went overnight from full to bare. Rain fell without stop. At last, a needed boon. We got word that a few hours north in Seattle, at the Rainier International Classic,
A fiery Romanian tennis player was destroying every opponent in his path, and doing it in a brand new pair of Nike Match Points. The Romanian was Ile Năstase, a.k.a. Nasty. And every time he hit his patented overhead smash, every time he went up on his toes and stroked another unreturnable serve, the world was seeing our swoosh. We'd known for some time that athlete endorsements were important. If we were going to compete with Adidas, not to mention Puma and Gola, and Deodora and Head and Wilson and Spalding, and Carhu and Etonic and New Balance and all the other brands popping up in the 1970s, we'd need top athletes wearing and talking up our brand. But we still didn't have money to pay top athletes. We had less money than ever before. Nor did we know the first thing about getting to them, persuading them that our shoe was good, that it would soon be better, that they should endorse us at a discounted price. Now here was a top athlete already wearing Nike, and winning in it. How hard could it be to sign him? I found the number for Năstase's agent. I phoned and offered him a deal. I said I'd give him $5,000, I gagged as I said it, if this boy would wear our stuff. He countered with $15,000. How I hated negotiating. We settled on $10,000. I felt that I was being robbed. Năstase was playing a tourney that weekend in Omaha, the agent said. He suggested I fly out with the papers. I met Nasty and his wife, Dominique, a stunning woman, that Friday night at a steakhouse in downtown Omaha. After I got him to sign on the dotted line, after I locked the papers in my briefcase, we ordered a celebratory dinner, a bottle of wine, another bottle. At some point, for some reason, I started speaking with a Romanian accent. And for some reason, Nasty started calling me Nasty. And for no reason I could think of, his supermodel wife started making goo-goo eyes at everyone, including me. And by night's end, stumbling up to my room, I felt like a tennis champion and a tycoon and a kingmaker. I lay in bed and stared at the contract. $10,000, I said aloud to the empty room. $10,000. It was a fortune. But Nike had a celebrity athlete endorser. I closed my eyes to stop the room from spinning. Then I opened them because I didn't want the room to stop spinning. Take that, Kitami, I said to the ceiling, to all of Omaha. Take that. Back then, the historic football rivalry between my University of Oregon Ducks and the dreaded Oregon State Beavers was lopsided at best. My Ducks usually lost, and they usually lost by a lot, and they often lost with a lot on the line. In 1957, with the two teams vying for the conference crown, Oregon's Jim Shanley was going in for the winning touchdown when he fumbled on the one-yard line. Oregon lost 10-7. In 1972, my Ducks had lost to the Beavers 8 straight times, sending me 8 straight times into a sour funk. But now in this topsy-turvy year, my Ducks were going to wear Nikes. Hollister had persuaded Oregon's head coach, Dick Enright, to don our new waffle-soled shoes for the big game, the Civil War. The setting was their place, down in Corvallis. Scattered rain had been falling all morning, and it was coming down in sheets by game time. Penny and I stood in the stands, shivering inside our sopping ponchos, peering into the raindrops as the opening kickoff spun into the air. On the first play from scrimmage, Oregon's burly quarterback, a sharpshooter named Dan Fouts, handed the ball to Donnie Reynolds, who made one cut on his Nike waffles and took it to the house. Duck 7, Nike 7, Beavers 0. Fouts, closing out a brilliant college career, was out of his mind that night. He passed for 300 yards, including a 60-yard touchdown bomb that landed like a feather in his receiver's hands. The rout was soon on. At the final gun, my Ducks were on top of the Bucktooths, 30-3. I always called them my Ducks, but now they really were. They were in my shoes. Every step they took, every cut they made, was partly mine. It's one thing to watch a sporting event and put yourself in the player's shoes. Every fan does that. It's another thing when the athletes are actually in your shoes. I laughed as we walked back to the car. I laughed like a maniac. I laughed all the way back to Portland. This, I kept telling Penny, this is how 1972 needed to end. With a victory. Any victory would have been healing, but this, oh boy, this. 1973. Like his coach, Pree just wasn't himself after the 1972 Olympics. He was haunted and enraged by the terrorist attacks and by his performance. He felt he'd let everyone down. He'd finished fourth. No shame in being the world's fourth best at your distance, we told him. But Pree knew he was better than that, and he knew he'd have done better if he hadn't been so stubborn. He showed no patience, no guile. He could have slipped behind the front runner, coasted in his wake, stolen silver. That, however, went against Pree's religion. So he'd run all out, as always, holding nothing back. And in the final 100 yards, he tired. Worse, the man he considered his arch-rival, Lasse Varen of Finland, once more took the gold. We tried to lift Pree's spirits. We assured him that Oregon still loved him. City officials in Eugene were even planning to name a street after him. Great, Pree said. What are they going to call it, Fourth Street? He locked himself in his metal trailer on the banks of the Willamette and didn't come out for weeks. In time, after pacing a lot, after playing with his German shepherd puppy Lobo, and after large quantities of cold beer, Pree emerged. One day I heard that he'd been seen again around town, at dawn, doing his daily 10 miles, Lobo trotting at his heels. It took a full 6 months, but the fire in Pree's belly came back. In his final races for Oregon, he shone. He won the NCAA 3-mile for a fourth straight year, posting a gaudy 13:05.3. He also went to Scandinavia and crushed the field in the 5,000, setting an American record, 13:22.4. Better yet, he did it in Nikes. Bowerman finally had him wearing our shoes, and our shoes were finally worthy of Pree. Bowerman, months into his retirement, was still coaching Pree, still polishing the final designs for the waffle shoe, which was about to go on sale to the general public. He'd never been busier. It was a perfect symbiotic match. He was generating thousands of dollars of publicity, making our brand a symbol of rebellion and iconoclasm, and we were helping his recovery. Pree began to talk privately with Bowerman about the 1976 Olympics in Montreal. He told Bowerman and a few close friends that he wanted redemption. He was determined to capture that gold medal that eluded him in Munich. Several scary stumbling blocks stood in his path, however. Vietnam, for one. Pree, whose life, like mine, like everyone's, was governed by numbers, drew a horrible number in the draft lottery. He was going to be drafted, there was little doubt, as soon as he graduated. In a year's time, he'd be sitting in some fetid jungle, taking heavy machine gun fire. He might have his legs, his godlike legs, blown out from under him. Also, there was Bowerman. Pree and the coach were clashing constantly, two headstrong guys with different ideas about training methods and running styles. Bowerman took the long view. A distance runner peaks in his late 20s. He therefore wanted Pree to rest, preserve himself for certain select races, save something. Bowerman kept pleading. But, of course, Pree refused. "I'm all out, all the time," he said. In their relationship, I saw a mirror of my relationship with Banks. Pree didn't see the sense in going slow, ever. Go fast or die. I couldn't fault him. I was on his side, even against our coach. Above all, however, Pree was broke. The know-nothings and oligarchs who governed American amateur athletics at that time decreed that Olympic athletes couldn't collect endorsement money or government money, which meant our finest runners and swimmers and boxers were reduced to paupers. To stay alive, Pree sometimes tended bar in Eugene, and sometimes he ran in Europe, taking illicit cash from race promoters.
Of course, those extra races were starting to cause issues. His body, in particular his back, was breaking down. At Blue Ribbon, we worried about Pri. We talked about him often, formally and informally, around the office. Eventually, we came up with a plan. To keep him from injuring himself, to avoid the shame of him going around with a begging bowl, we hired him. In 1973, we gave him a job, a modest salary of $5,000 a year, and access to a beach condo Kale owned in Los Angeles. We also gave him a business card that said National Director of Public Affairs. People often narrowed their eyes and asked me what that meant. I narrowed my eyes right back. It means he can run fast, I said. It also meant he was our second celebrity athlete endorser. The first thing Pri did with his Nike windfall was go out and buy himself a Butterscotch MG. He drove it everywhere, fast. It looked like my old MG. I remember feeling enormously, vicariously proud. I remember thinking, we bought that. I remember thinking Pri was the living, breathing embodiment of what we were trying to create. Whenever people saw Pri going at his breakneck pace, doing his morning miles, zipping around in his MG, I wanted them to see Nike. And when they bought a pair of Nikes, I wanted them to see Pri. I felt this strongly about Pri, even though I'd only had a few conversations with the man. And you could hardly call them conversations. Whenever I saw him at a track or around the Blue Ribbon offices, I became mute. I tried to calm myself. More than once I told myself that Pri was just a kid from Coos Bay, a short, shaggy-haired jock with a porn star mustache. But I knew better. And a few minutes in his presence would prove it. A few minutes was all I could take. The world's most famous Oregonian at that time was Ken Kesey, whose blockbuster novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, appeared in 1962, the exact moment I left on my trip around the world. I knew Kesey at the University of Oregon. He wrestled and I ran track, and on rainy days we'd do indoor workouts at the same facility. When his first novel came out, I was stunned by how good it was, especially since the plays he'd written in school had been dreck. Suddenly he was a literary lion, the toast of New York. And yet I never felt starstruck in his presence, as I did in Pri's. In 1973, I decided that Pri was every bit the artist that Kesey was, and more. Pri said as much himself. "A race is a work of art," he told a reporter, "that people can look at and be affected in as many ways as they're capable of understanding." Each time Pri came into the office, I noted I wasn't alone in my swooning. Everyone became mute. Everyone became shy. Men, women, it didn't matter. Everyone turned into Buck Knight, even Penny Knight. If I was the first to make Penny care about track and field, Pri was the one who made her a real fan. Hollister was the exception to this rule. He and Pri had had an easy way around each other. They were like brothers. I never once saw Hollister act any differently with Pri than he did with, say, me. So it made sense to have Hollister, the Pri-whisperer, bring Pri in, help us get to know him, and vice versa. We arranged a lunch in the conference room. When the day came, it wasn't wise, but it was typical of Woodell and me. We chose that moment to tell Hollister that we were tweaking his duties. In fact, we told him the second his butt hit the chair in the conference room. The change would affect how he got paid. Not how much, just how. Before we could fully explain, he threw down his napkin and stormed out. Now we had nobody to help us break the ice with Pri. We all sat silent, staring stone-faced into our sandwiches. Pri spoke first. "Is Jeff coming back?" "I don't think so," I said. Long pause. "In that case," Pri said, "can I eat his sandwich?" We all laughed, and Pri seemed suddenly mortal, and the luncheon ultimately proved invaluable. Shortly after that day, we soothed Hollister and tweaked his duties again. "From now on," we said, "you're Pri's full-time liaison. You're in charge of handling Pri, taking Pri out on the road, introducing Pri to the fans.
In fact, we told Hollister, take the boy on a cross-country tour. Hit all the track meets, state fairs, high schools, and colleges you can. Go everywhere and nowhere. Do everything and nothing. Sometimes Pree would conduct a running clinic, answering questions about training and injuries. Sometimes he'd just sign autographs and pose for photos. No matter what he did, no matter where Hollister took him, worshipful crowds would appear around their bright blue Volkswagen bus. Though Pree's job title with Blue Ribbon was intentionally imprecise, his role was real, and his belief in Nike was authentic as well. He wore Nike t-shirts everywhere he went, and he allowed his foot to be Bowerman's last for all shoe experiments. Pree preached Nike as gospel and brought thousands of new people into our revival tent. He urged everyone to give this groovy new brand a try, even his competitors. He'd often send a pair of Nike flats or spikes to a fellow runner with a note. Try these. You'll love them. Among those most inspired by Pree was Johnson. While continuing to build up our East Coast operation, Johnson spent much of 1972 slaving on something that he christened the Pree Montreal, a shoe that would be an homage to Pree and to the upcoming Olympics and to the American Bicentennial. With a blue suede toe, a red nylon back, and a white swoosh, it was our jazziest shoe yet, and also our best spike. We knew that we were going to live or die based on quality, and thus far our quality on spikes had been spotty. Johnson was going to fix that with this design. But he was going to do it in Oregon, I decided, not Boston. I'd been giving a lot of thought to Johnson for months. He was turning into a truly fine designer, and we needed to take full advantage of his talent. The East Coast was running smoothly, but it now involved too much administration for him. The whole thing needed reorganizing, streamlining, and that wasn't the best use of Johnson's time or creativity. That was a job tailor-made for someone like Waddell. Night after night during my 6-mile run, I'd wrestle with this situation. I had two guys in the wrong jobs, on the wrong coasts, and neither one was going to like the obvious solution. Each guy loved where he lived, and each irritated the other, though they both denied it. When I'd promoted Waddell to operations manager, I'd also bequeathed him Johnson. I'd put him in charge of overseeing Johnson, answering Johnson's letters, and Waddell made the mistake of reading them thoroughly and trying to keep up. Consequently, the two had developed a chippy, deeply sarcastic rapport. For instance, Waddell wheeled into my office one day and said, "This is depressing. Jeff complains constantly about inventory, expense reimbursements, lack of communications. He says he's working his butt off while we're lolling around. He doesn't listen to any reason, including that our sales are doubling every year." Waddell told me he wanted to take a different approach to Johnson. "By all means," I said, "have at it." So he wrote Johnson a long letter admitting that we'd all been colluding against him, trying to make him unhappy. He wrote, "I'm sure you realize we don't work quite as hard out here as you do. With only 3 hours in the working day, it is hard to get everything done. Still, I make time to place you in all sorts of embarrassing situations with customers and the business community. Whenever you'd need money desperately to pay bills, I send only a tiny fraction of what you need so that you'll have to deal with bill collectors and lawsuits. I take the destruction of your reputation as a personal compliment." And so on. Johnson answered back, "Finally someone out there understands me." What I was getting ready to propose wasn't going to help. I approached Johnson first. I chose my moment carefully. A trip we made to Japan to visit Nippon Rubber and discuss the Pre-Montreal. Over dinner, I laid it all out for him. We were in a ferocious battle, a siege. Day by day, we were doing everything we could to keep the troops fed and the enemy at bay. For the sake of victory, for the sake of survival, everything else needed to be sacrificed, subordinated. And so, at this crucial moment in the evolution of Blue Ribbon, in the rollout of Nike, I'm sorry, but, well, you two dummies need to switch cities. He groaned, of course. It was Santa Monica all over again. Then slowly, agonizingly, he came around, as did Waddell.
Around the close of 1972, each man handed his house keys to the other, and now, in early 1973, they switched places. Talk about team players. It was an enormous sacrifice, and I was deeply grateful. But in keeping with my personality and Blue Ribbon tradition, I expressed no gratitude. I spoke not a word of thanks or praise. In fact, I referred to the switch in several office memos as Operation Dummy Reversal. In the late spring of 1973, I met with our recent investors, the debenture holders, for a second time. The first time, they'd loved me. How could they not? Sales were booming, celebrity athletes were promoting our shoes. Sure, we'd lost Onitsuka, and we were facing a legal fight down the road, but we were on the right track. This time, however, it was my duty to inform the investors that, 1 year after launching Nike, for the first time in Blue Ribbon history, we'd lost money. The meeting took place at the Valley River Inn in Eugene. It was 30 men and women crammed into the conference room with me at the head of a long conference table. I wore a dark suit and tried to project an air of confidence as I delivered the bad news. I gave them the same speech I'd given Blue Ribbon employees a year before. We've got them right where we want them. But this group wasn't buying any pep talks. These were widows and widowers, retirees and pensioners. Also, the previous year, I'd been flanked by Jaqua and Bowerman. This year, both men were busy. I was alone. Half an hour into my pitch, with 30 horrified faces staring at me, I suggested we break for lunch. The previous year, I'd handed out Blue Ribbon's financial statements before lunch. This year, I decided to wait until after. It didn't help. Even on a full stomach, with a chocolate chip cookie, the numbers looked bad. Despite $3.2 million in sales, we showed a net loss of $57,000. Several clusters of investors now began private conversations while I was trying to talk. They were pointing at this troubling number, $57,000, and repeating it like a curse. At some point, I mentioned that Ann Karras, a young runner, had just made the cover of Sports Illustrated wearing Nikes. "We're breaking through, people." No one heard. No one cared. They cared only about the bottom line. Not even the bottom line, but their bottom line. I came to the end of my presentation. I asked if anyone had a question. 30 hands went up. "I'm very disappointed in this," said one older man, rising to his feet. "Any more questions?" I said. 29 hands went up. Another man called out, "I'm not happy." I said I sympathized. My sympathy only served to annoy them. They had every right. They'd put their confidence in Bowerman and me, and we'd failed. We never could have anticipated Tiger's betrayal, but nonetheless, these people were hurting. I saw it in their faces, and I needed to take responsibility, to make it right. I decided it was only fair to offer them a concession. Their stock had a conversion rate, which went up every year. In the first year, the rate was $1 a share. In the second year, it was $1.50, and so on. In light of all this bad news, I told them, I'll keep the conversion rate the same for the full 5 years you own your stock. They were placated, mildly. But I left Eugene that day knowing they had a low opinion of me and Nike. I also left thinking I'd never, ever, ever take this company public. If 30 people could cause this kind of acid stomach, I couldn't imagine being answerable to thousands of stockholders. We were better off financing through Nisho and the bank. That is, if there was anything to finance. As feared, Onitsuka had filed suit against us in Japan. So now we had to file quickly against them in the United States for breach of contract and trademark infringement. I put the case in the hands of Cousin Hauser. It wasn't a tough call. There was the trust factor, of course, kinship, blood, so on. Also, there was the confidence factor. Though he was only 2 years older, Cousin Hauser seemed vastly more mature. He carried himself with remarkable assurance, especially before a judge and jury. His father had been a salesman, and a good one, and Cousin Hauser learned from him how to sell his client. Better yet, he was a tenacious competitor. When we were kids, Cousin Hauser and I used to play vicious marathon games of badminton in his backyard. One summer, we played exactly 116 games. Why 116? Because Cousin Hauser beat me 115 straight times. I refused.